Welcome, everybody. This is the first office hours session for the Mises Academy class on the economics of the Great Depression. Today's date is November 17th, 2012. I always like to do that so that after the economic collapse, future historians can at least figure out when these strange recordings were made. So for those of you who are logged in here at this point, there's about six or seven of you. So this is this might be your first time taking a class from me. So this is just a free-for-all. Just write in your chat box there. Just go ahead and type whatever questions you want me to answer. And also don't feel like you need to wait for me to, you know, so if someone posts a question and I'm answering it and then you know something you want to ask me, don't wait for me to finish because I regulate the length of my answers based on how many questions are sitting in the chat box. So go ahead and post it. You're not being rude. I'll see it and then adjust my brevity or long-windedness accordingly. So go ahead and knock yourselves out, guys. Start posting questions. Okay, great. Lewis asks, and also one last thing for those who are new to this. It's obviously if you have a question pertaining to the material that I just covered this week or in previous weeks, for this course, by all means, you know, post that and we'll concentrate on that, but this you can ask me just about anything. If it's too personal, I'll just decline to answer. Okay, Lewis says, what do you think has been holding the gold price from skyrocketing to, example, $4,000? Sounds like it will be getting there at some point in the near future, right? Well, it's foolish for me to say something specific because then there's a chance it could be wrong and I look like an idiot. I have been surprised at how much it seems the markets believe that Bernanke is going to just withdraw all this liquidity once the economy recovers. All right, so if you look at, for example, let me back up for a second. It seems like there's this bifurcation in the markets between the precious metals and the bond markets, where if you just looked at the gold price since, let's say, 2007, it sure looks like lots of people are worried about what Bernanke's been doing, right? Now, Lewis, you're right. You might say that they're underestimating it, that they're not worried enough, but still, the gold price has certainly gone up, and so I can sleep at night because I've been telling people, like in my blog and just in personal conversation, you know, when I give talks on the matter, when people were saying, you know, what should we do? I would say, you know, as a boilerplate answer, well, you know, if you don't have any gold or silver, get some of that, get out of variable rate credit card debt, you know, that kind of stuff. So certainly I don't feel like I did anybody wrong by steering them into gold and silver back in 2008, which is what I was doing. On the other hand, though, it's one of the trump cards that the Keynesians, but not even just the Keynesians, but even like guys like Scott Sumner, who think that the Fed needs to inflate more, or at least promise future inflation, or change the nature of what they've been doing and the way they frame their policies to the public so that the public believes there's going to be more aggregate demand down the road. The trump card that these guys play, who say that the Fed hasn't been doing enough, is to say, you got you Austrians talking about gold and, oh my gosh, a dollar collapse. You guys are crazy. Look at the bond markets. The yields on 30-year treasuries are pretty low if price inflation is going to take off any day now, like you guys are warning us about. Right? So it's not merely, they're saying, it's not merely that over the next few years, it looks like the markets don't expect prices to go through the roof. But over a 20 and 30 year stretch, they believe the Fed's forecasts. Because if you thought price inflation were going to be, let's say, 5% or higher starting in 2015 and then going forward, then why would you be willing to have such a low nominal rate of return on long-term treasuries, which is what is happening in the markets? Okay, so there's, and the thing is, it's not, one way you could try to get around that if you're an Austrian who thinks that, come on, everybody has to know that the dollar is going to really start getting hammered at some point once we get through this emergency phase. One thing you could say is, oh, well, gee, the Fed is buying up all these treasuries, and so that's what's keeping the yields artificially low. But the thing is, even if you look at like the spread between nominal and TIPS bonds, so TIPS are, it's an acronym for Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. So on those are bonds that the federal government issues where they automatically increase the principal based on CPI. And so in theory, to a rough approximation, if you don't worry about liquidity and stuff like that, the difference between the return on a 20-year normal treasury and a 20-year TIPS treasury should show you what the expected CPI inflation rate is over that same 20-year stretch. And it's not a big number if you do that calculation. And so it looks like a lot of investors believe Bernanke and the rest of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee when they give their press briefings and say, this is our forecast for what price inflation is going to be over the next blah, blah, blah. So that's a long way of me saying, Lewis, it's hard because, you know, we tend to say how smart markets are and things like that, and it's one thing to say, you know, like when housing was in a bubble, you know, you say, oh, okay, they could be like a self-sustaining thing, but for treasuries to be in a bubble, which is the only conclusion you can come up with, so that's what I think. If you're asking me, do you think Bernanke's right and that price inflation, at least as gauged by official CPI, is going to be like between 2 and 3% for the next 10 years? No, that seems crazy to me. And so then when you say, well, then why are investors tolerating such low yields? Do they really believe, you know, and I don't know. And I don't know if I had more time, especially if I had clients who were paying me to look into this stuff, I would try to get more sophisticated and look at, like, the derivatives markets and try to back out. Because some of it could just be, you know, people are panicked, and so they want to hold treasuries just in case things collapse over the next few years, and they want to just have that security, even though knowing full well if price inflation really kicks in, they're going to get whacked. Still, you know, treasuries are considered the safest asset, at least in terms of typical financial assets. So there's all kinds of different things going on. And I guess what I'm saying to you, Lewis, is it seems like there's this sort of bifurcation where the people who are panicked, they're in the precious metals, and the people who expect deflation are in, obviously, dollar-denominated assets and things like that, bonds. And it could just be like that's the way the equilibrium has played out. There certainly is this divergence. I mean, it's not like we're all agreeing on the big picture and we're just differing in the details. I mean, there are people who think if Bernanke doesn't do more and actively keep intervening, that prices will actually start going down, where there are other people like me and Peter Schiff and probably a lot of people associated with the Mises Institute who think if Bernanke doesn't start taking steps pretty quickly to undo what he's already set in motion, then the dollar is in store to get whacked. So, I mean, we're thinking things are going to go in the opposite directions, and it's an odd, and part of the reason is that this is a very, well, not even very, it's literally unprecedented in terms of U.S. history. There has never been a situation like this where we've had so many excess reserves just sitting there. And you can look at Japan and say, well, what's happened there? And well, I'm kind of going out far afield here, so I'll pull it back. If you want to come back, you can post more questions. So to give you a quick answer, will gold at some point be above $4,000 per ounce? I think so. Is it going to happen in the near future? Maybe not, because the way I think things are going to happen is, if I had to guess, so don't go betting your house on this prediction. My guess is Europe's going to go down first, like the euro system will collapse first, and then that will give temporary strength to the dollar because everyone's going to be fleeing euro-denominated assets, and what are they going to do? I think they're going to go to the dollar first, and then that will buy the U.S. a few more years, and will, you know, make the gold bugs look foolish. All of, you know, Paul Krugman's going to be running victory laps saying, whoa, Peter Schiff was worried about a dollar crash. The dollar's stronger now than it's been in two decades. But it's only because the euro is collapsing after doing Keynesian solutions to all this garbage. And then so that goes down first, so everyone flees to the dollar. That makes the Fed just pump in more and more money because it seems like, hey, there's no pain. Why don't we just create hundreds of billions of dollars worth of wealth with no downside? And then once that dam bursts, it's going to be awful. So, but that might take a decade to play out. So who knows? I can't imagine somebody who's buying gold now and is able to hold on to it for 10 years, after 10 years is going to say, oh, man, I wish I hadn't put so much of my wealth in gold back in 2012. That seems very unlikely to me. But it is conceivable to me that gold could just tread water for a couple of years measured in dollars. Even there, I don't think that's going to happen. Because if Europe crashed and the dollar strengthened, I still think the dollar price of gold would go up. Because in addition to people fleeing the euro and going into dollars, they're certainly going to go into gold. So even if the dollar strengthens against the euro and the yen and the whatever else, yuan and so forth, I think gold would strengthen against all those things too, and probably even against the dollar. But okay, William Dwyer says, could you say something about the fiscal cliff? Okay. So that, especially for the benefit of foreign viewers or listeners, if you're just listening to the audio version of this, the fiscal, what's happening is there were, so what's called the Bush tax cuts refers to the fact that George W. Bush, when he came into office, so there was the 2000 election, so he's sworn in 2001. Part of his signature policies were two stages of tax rate reductions. Okay, so he reduced federal income tax rates from what they had been under President Bill Clinton, and he did it in two stages. I think in 2001 and 2003, but don't quote me on those years. So, and the way U.S. politics works, they keep calling them the Bush tax cuts, and so here's what happened. If they didn't make it a permanent tax rate reduction, the way the legislation was concocted or phrased was to, it would make it, they have a sunset provision, meaning the legislation that George Bush signed that reduced federal income tax rates had a built-in expiration date. And the reason they did that is that in U.S. politics, when you have a tax bill or any kind of bill, any kind of legislation, they can send it over to the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, to score it, to say how much is this going to cost. So when they if it's a tax cut bill, you know, a bill that reduces tax rate, they can send it over to the CBO and say, hey, how much does this thing cost? And so the CBO will run its models that that aren't calibrated to be very sensitive to so-called supply side effects or Laffer curve effects. So in these models, if the government reduces tax rates, it shows up as saying, oh my gosh, that's going to increase the deficit by a lot, because they don't, in their computer model, they don't have the economy growing a lot more because tax rates are lower. It's just like, hey, the pie is going to grow at a certain rate no matter what the government does. And so if you're taxing at a lower rate, the government brings in less revenue. So they come up with all these statistics saying, oh, the Bush tax cuts for the rich are going to, you know, cost us $2 trillion over the next X years, you know, that kind of thing. So in order to lower that number so that Democrat opponents of the tax cut legislation couldn't point to as big a number to say how irresponsible this is for George Bush to be giving tax breaks to the wealthy, they built in a sunset provision so that when the CBO is scoring it, like the tax rate will only be in effect for a certain number of years, so that within the window that the CBO looks over, the tax rates went back up at the tail end of that window, bringing in more revenue. So when the CBO reports saying, oh, the cost of George Bush's tax cut bill is X trillion, that number's lower, all right? But they knew that it would be politically difficult, and that expiration approach, nobody wants to vote to allow taxes to go up. And so the Republicans who crafted it like that, thinking full well, we're going to pass this now because the CBO is going to give us a low estimate of the cost, and then when it gets close to this thing to expire, there's going to be a big political fight, and everyone's going to vote, or not everyone, but enough people will vote to extend the Bush tax cuts. All right, so that's, because if you think about it, you wonder, well, how come we didn't call it extending the Clinton tax hikes or something like that? You see what I'm saying? And that was because when Clinton raised taxes, they had to bring in more revenue, so they didn't need to build in a sunset provision. They, it helped them to show, no, we're going to keep these rates in effect forever. So it's not like that was forever after called the Clinton tax rate. It was just that's what the rate is. Whereas with the Bush thing, it had a built-in expiration. So if you wanted to perpetuate the status quo, it was like you were cutting taxes again. Right? So that's, we're in this weird situation now where, so they kept, doing piecemeal extensions of it. And as part of the deal to raise the debt ceiling, so that's another wild card in all this, or another complication. In the United States, the federal government, the executive branch, the executive branch cannot just borrow money willy-nilly. The Treasury can't, Geithner, who's the Treasury Secretary, he can't just go out and just issue bonds and rack up all kinds of debt. That Congress has a specific debt ceiling, saying that the federal government, by law, cannot owe more than this amount of money if we're talking about the actual bonds that people hold, U.S. Treasury bonds. So in order for, Geithner, just legally, he can't just go out and borrow more money once they hit the debt ceiling. So as part of the fight to raise the debt ceiling the last time it was getting close to hitting it, there were all kinds of agreements about, we gotta get spending under control, and so they had all these deals and things like that. So the point is, all these various things come to a head because with the recession, nobody wanted to raise taxes in the middle of the Great Recession, and no one wanted to cut spending, and so they just kept doing temporary one-year extensions of these things. So the point is, all of this stuff expires such that in January 2013, if they don't take action, the way the legislation is right now and everything, the status quo, if you will be that the tax rates will automatically go up and various types of spending cuts will automatically occur. So the point is, Congress has to pass new legislation to prevent that from happening. And they're calling that the fiscal cliff because it's kind of a Keynesian notion in the sense that raising taxes and cutting spending will take away government stimulus. So as an Austrian, I agree raising tax rates is bad. That's going to hurt the economy. But I actually think cutting spending will be good. So in that respect, bring the cliff on. Let's dive over that thing. So, but anyway, that's what people mean by it. And so now they're all meeting and trying to come up with, can we come up with some last-minute deal to avoid this, or should we just let it happen? And that's what's going on. So, there's a big fight to various things. Like one major proposal would be, instead of just letting income tax rates go up, why don't we bring in a carbon tax as part of some big bipartisan deal? And there's even some, moderate Republicans who are bouncing that idea around. And I just know a lot about that because of my consulting work. But that's what the fiscal cliff is in a nutshell. And so, of course, Keynesians say it's stupid that we don't need to reduce the deficit right now. That right now the big issue is let's promote full employment and then make long-term structural changes to rein in the deficit over time. But whether we borrow $1 trillion this year or $800 billion or $1.4 trillion, in the grand scheme, that doesn't matter. You want to fix the economy first, And to do that, you got to boost aggregate demand. So that's like what Paul Krugman's position would be. Okay. If you want, William, if you want me to say more, just post a follow-up question, but I'll move on. Tony Hoffer says, can you explain what a dirty float is? It was mentioned in What Has Government Done to Our Money? Tony, let me, I'll answer that. I'm not going to answer on the fly here because I don't know enough about the content. I'd want to go reread what Rothbard was saying about it to make sure that I'm saying it in the same context he was. So I will, let me write myself a little note here. So I'll answer that, but in the Moodle framework, you know what I mean? I'll send out a thing saying I've answered the questions from week one, and I'll do it there. Because right now I'm afraid if I just started talking extemporaneously, I would end up saying something, and then I'd go read Rothbard and say, oh, shoot, Rothbard meant in a different context. Okay, Rob Gilmore says, how will Bernanke know that the economy has recovered? How will the rest of us know? Rob, you mean like if Bernanke says, don't worry, I'm going to withdraw all of this extraordinary support once the economy starts to recover? If that's what you mean, I mean, their official, if you're asking me what is Bernanke's official position, that's what I'm telling you. So I don't agree with this, but I think he would just say, well, you know, once we see the employment figures rising, once official unemployment rates start coming down, and then also once we start seeing consumer prices, and in particular, because they don't just look at the headline CPI, he looks at, I'm drawing a blank, the consumer personal expenditure index or something like that. The point is they don't even just look at CPI with food and energy removed. They look at something else, like personal consumption expenditures, PCE, that's the thing they look at. So that's what he wants to target, between 1% and 2%. So, because that happened to me before, I thought I caught Bernanke just even being wrong on his own criterion, and I blogged about that, and someone pointed out, no, the Fed doesn't target headline CPI, they do such and such. So anyway, they're operating within this framework of, there's a Phillips curve, a trade-off between unemployment and price inflation, and right now we're at a situation where the danger is prices falling and unemployment being too high, so we clearly want to, you know, be very accommodative, that there's no problem keeping interest rates really low, having an easy money policy, because there's no sign of inflation, by which I mean price inflation, overheating right now, and unemployment is still way too high. And so the way Bernanke phrases things is, I think he would say, if price inflation got above our target zone, then we would start to have to worry about that trade-off. In other words, once price inflation's higher than we want it to be, but unemployment's still also higher than we want it to be, then we'd be in a quandary. But right now, that's not really an issue because price inflation is within the sweet spot and unemployment is higher than we want it to be. So clearly, it's incumbent upon us to still have a very accommodative policy. So I think the official plan that he gives is to tell people this, you know, once the economy's starting to recover, it's taking a while, we know it's painful, but hey, just grin and bear it. And then once it picks up, you'll see unemployment come down, you'll start to see prices rising again, and then we'll just sort of gradually let things unwind. So we'll start raising our target interest rate, we will stop buying $40 billion worth of stuff every month. We'll stop QE3, and then we'll just let the assets on our books start maturing, and so that our balance sheet will just shrink over time. We'll be effectively sucking money out of the economy, but that's fine because the economy will, you know, start being self-sustaining at that point. And so just like we gradually and naturally expanded our balance sheet because the economy was going into free fall and we arrested the fall. Now the economy starts to recover, we'll just pull back and let stuff naturally unwind. You know, 'cause we don't want to do it too fast. We don't want to just like sell everything on our balance sheet on Tuesday and suck out $2 trillion from the economy because then we'll cause a depression. But we'll just let, you know, we'll just pull back naturally. And so he thinks they can thread the needle where they're going to be able to withdraw that accommodation without causing a double dip, as they would call it. And they think they can pull it out quickly enough so that we don't start having price inflation of 5, 6, 7% annually. So I don't think there's any way they're going to do that, but that's what the plan is. If you're saying how will the rest of us know, meaning how would we know if Bernanke thought that's where we were, they're making a big push about being very transparent. And so, I mean, if you really get into the weeds of this stuff and look at the Fed watchers and people blogging about the Fed and so on, they actually, it's ridiculous, but people really parse their statements. And so they'll do things like, I'm trying to think. I'm not going to be able to give you a specific example that I know for sure is one that's real, but it's something like this. Like, it used to be that the Fed would say, we're going to keep these policies in force until such time as we feel they need to be withdrawn. And now they said in this most recent FOMC statement, we're going to keep these extraordinarily low interest rates in place for through 2014 or until such time as we feel the need to withdraw. And so the two statements technically are equivalent because they both say we have the right to withdraw this once we think the time is right. But the second statement, by throwing in this sort of irrelevant and without any force phrase, until 2014 or until such time as we want to withdraw support, which could be before 2014, that tells markets, gives them a little more information. You know, like, it's probably going to be 0% interest rates all through next year. But it might not be, but probably. You know what I mean? So real little nuances like that is what people focus on. Oh my gosh, what is the Fed telling us? It's ridiculous, but when you have the printing press at your command, people listen to what you have to say, even if it's looking in your facial text. So the point of me saying that was, in theory, the Fed is telling investors, we're going to be very transparent with you. We're going to let you know not merely what we're doing, but also the framework we're using to evaluate things. So it's not going to surprise you. You're going to know well in advance, these are the kind of things that would trigger us to start raising interest rates. And that sort of stuff. Okay. Vladimir, who apparently is tuning in at 3 a.m. his time, so you should reevaluate your life choices, says, the gold standard means a limited amount of money backed in gold. How does it reflect on a growing population which need the, which has a need for money that is growing also. And what if there is not enough real gold to back the need of the growing population? Okay. Let's see. So that's a good question, and there's theoretically there's really no issue about, you know, needing the gold supply to be growing. Right? So what, even if the gold stock stopped, you know, let's just say everyone's using gold as money, and then they just next Wednesday turns out, oh my gosh, there's no more gold left under the surface of the earth. That's it. All the gold that exists, we have already brought to the surface, and it has all been stamped into coins or, you know, used in people's dental work and so forth, and that's it. All the gold that will ever be discovered in human history has been discovered and is now, you know, in somebody's possession, part of somebody's property. That would still be fine. That wouldn't be a problem. There might be an adjustment period for people's expectations, and if people wrote contracts expecting gold to continue to be mined and so on. I mean, so there might be problems in that respect, but I mean, once that adjustment were made, there's no reason that the world economy couldn't use a fixed quantity of gold as the money stock forever. And what that would mean is simply that as the population grew and as output, you know, real output grew, then you're right. I think what you're getting at is the demand to hold money would keep growing as more and more people, the population kept growing. And that's fine. And so if the supply of money is fixed and the demand keeps growing, what does that mean? It means the price of the money keeps going up. And so if we're talking about the price of money, that's equivalent to saying the price of goods and services quoted in the money units goes down. So all we're saying is there would be a general fall in prices, meaning a general rise in the purchasing power of gold. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, during the classical gold standard period, there were long stretches where that would happen, where consumer prices in particular would gently fall over time. And so if you had gold coins and just put them under your mattress or, you know, put them in a piggy bank in your closet or your safe in your house, over time you could buy more and more real goods and services with those things. So that was a form of saving that earned, in a sense, an interest return in real purchasing power terms. Obviously, the nominal return is zero on cash. So there's nothing, theoretically, there's no problem, and even empirically, you could see that there were stretches where that happened. So that's what I would say. Now, I mean, what you... what you don't want is, I mean, practically speaking, if for some reason they couldn't mine more gold and then people started using gold in some kind of process that destroyed it. Like, you know, maybe there's some medical procedure or some chemical procedure, like for sending ships to the moon that uses gold. That's just the best way to do it, and but it destroyed the gold, and, you know, turns it into something else. And so the gold stopped shrinking over time. Again, theoretically, that's fine. People would just adjust that in their expectations. If they were signing long-term contracts, they would take that into account that gold's purchasing power was going to rise by 25% per year. So at some point, they might switch to use something else as the money. You know, like, You wouldn't want it to be that there's one atom of gold left on Earth and everybody has electronic claims of that one thing and that's the money. I mean, that would be crazy. So it's, there are limits to what I'm talking about, and the reason gold historically was the money was that its relative supply compared to the relative demand and so forth was pretty convenient in terms of the type of transactions that most people wanted to make. So that's why gold historically was chosen as money, not bronze, let's say, or not some other precious metal that was even rarer than gold. Okay, Tony Hoffer says, so by the way, we got about 20 more minutes left for this, so again, if you guys are actually there's people are posting the Q&A section. Okay. So by the way, just to avoid confusion in these things, just go ahead and post your questions in the main chat box like you guys have been doing. You don't need to post it in the Q&A. For the main lectures that happen on Friday, you want to segregate and put your questions in the Q&A because people are chit-chatting in the chat box. But here, it's small enough. Okay, so Tony Hoffer says, I looked up the gold price in 1812, and it was $19.39 per troy ounce. In the lecture, you said in 1912, it was $20.67 per ounce. Why do Keynesian, so of what that means for everybody who's just hearing this in the car or something. So over a 100-year stretch, the price of gold measured in dollars, assuming Tony's figures right, and I have no reason to doubt it, only went up by like a dollar change, like about 5 or 6% increase over a century. So Tony says, well, why do Keynesians call the gold standard unstable in light of this? The classical gold standard was stable. Right. I guess, well, we have to be a little bit careful. So I'm agreeing with you. I think people who say the gold standard causes all sorts of wild fluctuations, I mean, that's a crazy thing to say, considering what has happened historically since everybody went off gold. You want to talk about wild up and downs and currencies collapsing and stuff like that. I mean, that hyperinflation is a lot more volatile than whatever the heck happened on the classical gold standard. And even not even hyperinflation, but just the sorts of things we've seen happen either on the gold standard, or sorry, off the gold standard, or like I said, the Great Depression, I would argue, cannot be blamed on the gold standard for the reasons I talked about in the last lecture. So, certainly the second worst crisis in world history, and arguably the first one also, happened not on the gold standard. But to be fair, make sure we understand what a critic might mean, if the currency is when you're on the gold standard, the dollar can fluctuate against gold. All right, so by definition, if the dollar is defined as, you know, $20.67 per troy ounce of gold, as long as the U.S. government is maintaining that policy, the dollar price of gold is going to be pretty tied to that. You know, if you go look at the market price, it actually does deviate a little bit because, again, there's that bid-ask spread that the Treasury or the Fed is putting in place there. But if it ever, if the market price of gold ever went too high or too low relative to that anchor price, there'd be an arbitrage, and it would make sense for somebody to take gold off the market and turn it into the government, or vice versa, to take dollars and turn into government and get the gold and go sell it on the market and get more dollars. So the stability of the gold price measured in dollars, if you're looking at the country, or the stability of the of the gold price measured in a given currency for a government that's on the gold standard, you would expect that. So somebody who said it's very unstable, what they mean is if gold had been free to do whatever it wanted, suppose in reality gold should have been whipsawed all over the place. If you're stupid enough to tie your currency to gold so that it can't whipsaw, now the prices of everything else have to whipsaw. So that's where they're coming from. They're thinking, in other words, suppose prices would be normal. For example, I've heard people say this, look at what's happened since 2008. And they'd say, okay, what happened with on our fiat money standard is prices were pretty stable, consumer prices. They actually fell a little bit in late 2008. Then they recovered, and they've been rising modestly ever since. So, you know, if you have a basket of goods, bread, milk, gasoline, stuff that the average household buys, the price index of that has been rising for it. Whereas the gold price gone through the roof since 2008. So their point is gold is just a regular commodity. It has a very volatile price. And so if the government were stupid and listened to Ron Paul and made the dollar price of gold fixed, then, if gold wanted to go up, you know, the real price of gold increased from 2008 to now, the way it did in practice, but the dollar price is locked in at whatever, $1,500 an ounce or $1,000 an ounce or whatever Ron Paul or whoever had decided to lock it in back in 2008, then those real forces would still be there. So if gold got to be more valuable relative to bread and milk and real estate and other things, the way we know it did from 2008 to 2012, but you're forcing the dollar price of gold to stay constant, well, then the only way to achieve equilibrium is for the prices of everything else to go way down. So that's what their argument would be. So they're going to say, yeah, you can fix the price of gold, but not restore equilibrium. When the market wants gold to get more valuable relative to all these other things, if you're holding gold fixed and not letting gold get more expensive, then you're just forcing the price of everything else quoted in dollars to drop. And for various reasons, the Keynesians think that's an awful thing to have happen when you're already in a situation of high unemployment. The last thing in the world you want is to have wages need to drop 20%. They're saying it's a much easier thing to do to restore equilibrium by having the price of gold go up 20% rather than have the price of everything else go down 20%. So that's what they have in mind. Okay, Bob Trumbo says, temporary tax rate cuts impact people's decisions compared to a permanent tax rate cut, therefore less likely to positively impact the economy. Right, so Bob, you're presumably referring back to the Bush tax cuts and all that stuff and the extensions. Yeah, you're right. Well, it depends what you mean. I mean, actually, let's say the government were going to announce in the year 2013, we're going to get rid of the federal income tax altogether. So the tax rates will be 0% on any income you earn in the year 2013. But then in 2014, it'll go back to what it is now. So there'll be a one-year jubilee where any income you earn in that 1 year is going to be income tax-free. But then from 2014 onward, it's going to get booked back to being taxed at 35% or whatever. In that situation, you would see a huge boom in the economy in the year 2013. Because anybody who had any kind of business dealing up for you, they would pull forward as much as they could. Right? So I'm a consultant, and I have contracts with various clients. We would sign long-term deals, where I would talk to them and say, look, probably I'm going to do work for you for the next 5 years, right? And they'd say, yep. And I'd say, pay me now. Pay me a flat fee right now in 2013, and then I'm agreeing I'm going to do this work for you in 2013, 2014, 2015. You know what I'm saying? So they pay me now. I can book it. I report to the IRS. And I pay no tax, and then that's it. And then I got the money sitting, in some account somewhere, like in tax-free bonds or something. So then I don't pay any income tax now. So the point is, in terms of the reports of Americans' taxable income to the IRS, 2013 would see a huge, 50% jump relative to 2012. And then in the 2014, there would be a 25% drop in income. So if you just look at those statistics naively, it would look like the economy boomed in 2013 and then crashed in 2014. So that's not to say if they just said permanently we're getting rid of the federal income tax, that would be huge too. But the point is, the jump from 2012 to 2013 probably wouldn't be as big as if we thought there was just a one-year window, because then we wouldn't want to pull stuff forward. We would just expand into this is a new equilibrium, and now it makes sense for me to work more, because I get to keep more of what I earn. So, now you're right, Bob. I mean, It sounds like I'm saying it's the opposite of what you said. I'm just saying that's one particular factor you got to take into account. You're right, too, that like if I'm thinking about opening a new factory and it's, you know, it might be a little bit profitable, or if the consumer demand is there, but I'm not sure, and it's a borderline decision, and then the government comes along and says, oh, we're going to permanently lower corporate income taxes, the corporate income tax rate, forever. Now I'm going to say, oh, yeah, sure. I'll go ahead and invest that and build that factory and hire the workers and start making that product, because now I think for the next 20 years, the income that I think I might earn is not going to get taxed, or it's going to get taxed at a lower rate. Whereas the government comes in and says, oh, for the next year, we're going to do a temporary reduction in the corporate income tax rate. That might not affect my decision, because the 1 year, what do I care? So you're right. I mean, there's various nuances to all this. If what you're saying is, didn't the Bush tax cuts from a supply side Laffer curve type perspective, were they less effective because they had that temporary, or they had that sunset provision built into them? Probably. But again, they kind of did that thinking they were going to be self-perpetuating, that nobody was going to want to vote to increase the tax rates. So if you're a business person making your plans and you really are savvy and you know how the political process works, you might view that as equivalent to a permanent reduction. But maybe not. So, regardless of that, the Bush tax cuts were stupid from a supply side perspective. In other words, for the given costs of what they were supposed to be in terms of forfeited revenue, using the way the CBO runs their computer simulations, they could have had a comparable size tax cut that would be more likely to give incentives for businesses to expand and hire and for people to work more and that kind of stuff. So a lot of what they did, it was things that didn't increase your incentive to work on the margin, or didn't increase your incentive to earn income. So it was things like this might not be the example, but I'm just making this up. So I'm not saying this was part of the Bush tax cut package. But for example, if the government says, oh, we're going to give a $300 billion tax cut, so everybody in the country gets a $1,000 rebate on their income taxes, or $1,000 tax credit in addition to whatever other credits you claim. and that's the tax cut, right? So that should grow the economy, right? Make people go work more. Well, no. If everyone just gets basically a lump sum check from the government for